thanks for coming. Testing, testing, is this working? Okay, yeah, as Mike mentioned, great to have you out here. I noticed some of you came from my email list that I sent as well, thank you. Word pictures, a theology of the arts. Today I hope to, if you're an artist of any kind, I hope to encourage you. We're going to really look at the Bible, actually, and see how much imagination God uses. But also, if you're not an artist and just interested in the arts, you're also going to be encouraged and also educated, hopefully. Sadly, the church does not have a harmonious relationship with the arts, not always, through history. We've often been at odds with one another, suspicious of one another. Like Mike mentioned, oftentimes artists, we feel like, you know, we're the stepchild or the, you know, the second-class status in the church. And it's as if there are two competing worlds of reality, the spiritual and the sensual. And both the church and the artist have a hard time integrating orthodox theology and artistic imagination. We know the extremes of both of those, and I'll look at that in a minute, actually. But it's as if theology is too spiritual and otherworldly, and the arts are too sensual and this-worldly. And so today I want to prove this notion false. I want to provide a scriptural basis for a theology of the arts, so for harmony between goodness, truth, and beauty. I want to help provide a sensuous spirituality, as I like to call it, or an earthy spirituality. Let me first show you a film clip from a movie called Babette's Feast. It's a famous French film that captures the unease that at least the Protestant tradition has with the arts, with beauty. For those of you who haven't seen, how many have? Okay. There's two women, Philippa and Martina, two older women in this small village, and they're Puritans. They're Puritan-minded women. They live in a stark and holy Puritan village, and they really don't have a sense of beauty in their lives, only a mind for spiritual things. Because the spiritual is transcendent and we don't want to get caught up in the world. They're good women, but you know, that's their view. And there's a woman staying with them, Babette. That's Babette. She came from France, and they don't realize this because she's kept it a secret, but she was a famous chef in France. And to her, food is an art, and she is an artist of beauty. And these people live in such a dour state of deprived of beauty that she decides she's going to make a big, expensive feast for them. She spends all her money, they don't even realize this, she spends all this money that she had to make one feast for these precious villagers that she's come to fall in love with. And she doesn't tell them about it. She doesn't tell them how much it's costing and, you know, it's taking her whole life savings, basically. But she just wants to bless them with the beauty of food. So the scene we're going to see here is right before they're going, she's invited them all to the feast. These Puritan people are coming together. And the night before, one of the small little old ladies had a dream that scared her about the fleshliness of food, and so she tells the villagers she had this dream, and so they're really concerned that we don't want the flesh to pull us away from the spirit, so we're going to go in there because we love Babette, we're going to eat the food, but let's try to keep our minds focused on the spiritual things, and so we don't fall into temptation, right? So meanwhile, there's a non-Christian officer from the army, and he's visiting, so he's been around the world. And he's eating at this feast as well. And watch what he has to say, because he's the only one who recognizes the beauty of what they're eating. And notice how, watch the villagers as they seek to try to say spiritual so that they're not taken in by the flesh. The film clip's a little jumpy, sorry about that.
And now, let us pray in my pastor's own words.
Momi poli demi deum neo, momi deum shetens gema veo, momi sheco fatal gulce leo. Amen.
Like the wedding at Cana, the meal is not important.
We'll not even think about it.
That's the worldly officer.
One day in Paris, after I had won a writing competition, my French fellow officers extended an invitation to dinner. Thus did I have my first experience at that justly renowned restaurant, Café Anglais. Oddly, the chef of this restaurant was a female. We fed on caille en saccharage, a dish of her own creation and a delectable memory. The caille en saccharage were a favorite of General Gallifet. Now, the general had this rather interesting notion that this woman, this head chef, had the ability to transform a dinner into a kind of love affair. Yes, a love affair that made no distinction between spiritual and other appetites. And what we are dining on, I assure you, is nothing less than caille en saccharage.
Hallelujah. Dear brothers and sisters, the only things we can take with us from this earthly life are those that are given away.
Fruit General?
Ah, just look at these beauties.
Our joy in Jesus. Oh, how exciting to be a Christian. To be one of so many in prayer.
So there you see, it captures the, I think, the history of evangelicalism and Protestant struggle between the flesh and the spirit. A dichotomy that I think is unnecessary. We have a false dichotomy in the church, and since most of us here are artists, let me say this. It's a dichotomy between what I call word and image. Now, word, you might think of things like the spoken word, the written word, things like that. Logic, rationality. When you see image, don't just think visual images, think imagination. And you'll see, because in the church, I think we have, the traditional church tends to be a little bit word-oriented. The contemporary church tends to be more image-oriented. And the traditional church, of course, stresses doctrine. The contemporary stresses relationship. Traditional focuses on reason, and experience is the contemporary church's focus. We talk a lot about preaching the gospel in the traditional church, and the contemporary talks about living it out. Orthodoxy versus orthopraxy, right? You've heard that. Content versus style. Propositional truth is what the traditional church focuses on. But storytelling, the emergent church, the contemporary church, you know, those who are more aware tend to realize the value of. Truth and spirit. Rules versus freedom, right? There's a lot of rules in traditional churches. There's a lot of stress on freedom in the contemporary churches. The negative tendencies would be, in the traditional church, you have a tendency toward dead orthodoxy. They have the right beliefs, but it's very spiritually dead. But the contemporary church, there's a danger of anti-intellectualism, right? Spirit, relationship, and all that doctrine stuff is just irrelevant. And, of course, the tendencies, I'm not saying these are absolutes, but the tendency in the traditional church towards legalism, doing rules and all that, and license is the contemporary church, so love and free that they don't deal with sin. And books tend to be emphasized in the traditional church, but film, TV, pop culture tends to be emphasized in the contemporary church. And, of course, both sides then end up being either modernist or postmodernist. Now, most artists tend, obviously, towards the right side. In my personal life, I've sort of been a split personality, where in my religious faith and my spirituality, I've tended towards the left, but in my art, I was tended to the right. And thus I've had a split relationship within my own mind, as well as within the church. But what I want to suggest here is that, and I'm sure you already see it, that both extremes are wrong, and that both should have an equal ultimacy in our spirituality. And the example I use is, of course, the incarnation, Jesus Christ, the Word made image, the Word made flesh. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. Not only living in their presence, but also, that's a doctrinal statement in a way, the glory of God. So Jesus Christ is both Word and image equally. There is no second-class status, which also keep in mind, I'm not suggesting we swing the pendulum the other way and say, oh, you know, we've been too rational, so therefore we should be all image. No, no, no. But to the extent that in the church has lacked that aspect, we need to re-elevate that. So a proper theology is incarnational. It contains goodness, truth, right, ethics, doctrine, and beauty. Beauty always tends to be sort of like, oh, yeah, that too. No, no, it should be equally important. Today, I hope you're encouraged by that fact. Now, as a matter of fact, I would even say that if you do not have an aesthetic in your theology, aesthetics is a study of beauty, not just study of ethics, study of metaphysics, you know, these kinds of things, but a study of beauty, an understanding of beauty, you do not know God properly. That's how valuable beauty is to God. And too often, we artists struggle with our feelings of alienation in the church. They don't know what to do with us because we are those creative types. And too often, the word dominates in the church, and image is subordinated to that second-class status. So let's take a look at biblical aesthetics to see how important imagination is to God. I'm going to do a brief run-through. I went through the Bible, and I did a survey of it and found that about 20%, this is my scientific survey, 20% of it is propositional truth. Propositional statements are statements about, you know, they're verbal statements or written statements stating some fact or truth. But 80% of it is actually imagination, image, story, vision, poetry, and parable. That's a lot of imagination, folks. In fact, God is just as often speaks through vision and image and imagination as he does through words, spoken words. Even the miracles, think about the miracles. Those are pictorial signs and wonders. Imagination of God that are not propositions. Their signs are images. God said, I will be your God and you will be my people. He didn't say, I will be your proposition and you will be my systematizers. Now, this does not mean that the Bible is not concerned with doctrine and theology, right? What it means is that doctrinal truth and theology is communicated through or embedded within the imaginative constructs. So there doesn't need to be this sort of like, oh, doctrine and theology, imagination. It's both. Doctrine and theology is essential, and it's but it's, you know, I think the rationalized sort of Christian faith tends to stress systematic theology. But if you look at the Bible, there is no systematic theology in the Bible. So if you want to be strictly biblical, you want to communicate your doctrine and your truth and your theology through imaginative constructs. Let's take a brief look at the Old and New Testaments. We know that God does use words to communicate. Words are good, propositional truth. But not just poetry, I mean like propositional words versus poetry. But we need to realize that God often used visual imagery to communicate his word to his people. In the Old Testament, Abraham, Samuel, Ezekiel, Daniel, Obadiah, Habakkuk, all these guys received many visions from God, and the visions were the word of God. It wasn't just statements, it were visions, it were dreams, right? Isaiah says, the word which Isaiah, the son of Amos, saw. It wasn't words in the sky, right? In other words, when the Bible uses word, it doesn't mean what we use, but when we say word, when we say the word became flesh, we think of like words. Word actually is the communication of God, logos. That's what logos means, communication, not words. So God's communication, the prophet saw it. It wasn't just words. And, of course, in the New Testament, Ananias, Joseph, Peter, Paul, and the apostles, the prophets also had dreams and visions. And in Acts 2:17, where it says, you know, I will pour forth my spirit on all mankind. Your young men will see visions. Your old men will dream dreams. This isn't about charismatic theology. I'm just pointing out that whether you are or whether you're not, the New Testament says dreams, visions are still important to God in terms of communicating his word. Image in the word. God uses sensate image to reveal himself. He uses a lot of it, actually. We've got the burning bush. We've got the pillar of cloud by day. We've got the pillar of fire by night. This is all strong, this world images to communicate God's presence and reality. The glory cloud, the Shekinah glory. And, of course, God's favorite images are thunder, lightning, cloud, smoke, and fire that he uses. These are tactile, sensual, this world imaginative constructs that God uses to communicate his presence, his very presence. Now, this is my personal favorite, the temple, all right? The worship of God in the temple. The very heart and soul of the Old Testament was a sensate culture of imagination. The worship of God, the primary focus in the worship of God in the Old Testament, was a sensate culture of imagination. In the temple alone, the focus of their worship, we have representational art, right? We've got statues of angels on the Ark of the Covenant. We have huge statues of angels in the Holy of Holies. That's a big deal if you're a Protestant because you're always fearful of no images, you don't worship them, especially not in church. Well, guess what? Statues of angels in the Holy of Holies. We've got abstract art, right? The lampstands are like almond blossoms, and the high priest has purple pomegranates on his robe. And, of course, pomegranates are not purple. So there's abstract art going on in there. We've got symbolic art. The altar of the molten sea at the bottom of bronze with bulls holding it up. Very symbolic. The sea, etc. The high priest has 12... Oh, wait. The high priest has 12 stones that represent the 12 tribes of Israel. Symbolic. And then the columns have rims like lilies. And, of course, this is just a smattering of stuff. If you read that in the Bible, you'll see there's so much more in the temple. And, of course, we're all familiar with music. The Book of Psalms is not a systematic theology, but a hymn book full of theology for worship. The point is God values music as much or more than the sermon, at least in the worship that he has in the Bible. Music is essential to the human connection, and not just as an adornment or an ornament for the sermon. And, of course, dance, which this would be a hard one for a lot of Protestant churches, but Psalm 149:2 says, "Let the sons of Zion rejoice in their king. Let them praise his name with dancing." Imagine, you know, some of you may be in churches where they do the creative dancing, but I know in my traditions they were very fearful of that kind of thing. All this is to say that worshiping and understanding God was a very sensate, sensual experience, not abstract mental. All right? It includes both. But the worship in the temple was actually very sensate. And, of course, in the Bible itself, as we continue our quick survey, we know it's loaded with poetry. We've got religious poetry, friendship poetry, love poetry, not just love poetry, but erotic romance. the Song of Solomon is an erotic romance. This is my personal favorite passage. Again, very sensual. To be sensual is not intrinsically worldly. I love to say this poem to my wife often. "Oh, princess daughter, the curve of your hips are like jewels. Your belly is like a heap of wheat. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your stature is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I said, I will climb the palm tree and grab hold of its fruit stalks." All right, you're not going to hear this passage in churches, are you? But it's in the Bible in some churches. I know that on Mars Hill, they'll talk about that. You've got a lot of theatrical drama, not just in the Bible, but the way God communicates a lot of his prophecies are actually through drama. Ezekiel could be considered a thespian prophet. In this passage here, God basically tells him to perform a war epic as a prophecy, complete with a miniature city, and he besieges the city with a battering ram. It's like a little mini war epic, and that is actually the prophecy he is to give to Israel. It's not just gives him words, but he actually gives a dramatic performance. Many of Ezekiel's prophecies were actually performances. God told him to lay on his side for 430 days, tied up in ropes. He told him that another one was eating food cooked over burning excrement, as all as symbols of the sins of Israel heaped upon him. I mean, there's plenty of them. You know, dragging his baggage around day and night and hiding it, digging it into a, putting it into a hole in the wall of Israel. What was that about? That was a sign of the exile, of Israel's exile. So there's just tons of them. As a matter of fact, Jeremiah... There's also performance art as prophecy, not just dramatic performance, but literally performance art. We are maybe familiar with Isaiah. God told him to walk around naked for 3 years in the longest performance art ever as a sign of Israel's spirituality before God. Naked buttocks, it says, you know. Now, Jeremiah is called the weeping prophet, but he really should have been called the acting prophet because so many of his prophecies were literally theatrical performances. He was to hide his girdle by the Euphrates, break a potter's bottle in valley. These are all separate prophecies, by the way. Walking through the gates. These activities were the prophecy, folks. Wearing the yoke on his neck, purchasing deed to a field. These are all symbolic of God's word to Israel and talking about, you know, like I said, they're going into exile. They're you know, their relationship before God was being tried, and et cetera. So these are all symbolic. Now, understand, I am not saying that artists are the prophets of society. That's another school of thought that I don't actually subscribe to, but that's a leap of logic in my mind. I'm merely pointing out in the Old Testament that God himself considers these artistic expressions as so important to him that he uses them to communicate his word to us, so it's not second-class status. And of course, we're all very familiar with the parables. It's interesting that the apostles did not give a systematic course of lectures on soteriology, ecclesiology, pneumatology, and eschatology. They got parables of shepherds, virgins, prostitutes, thieves, fishermen, and farmers, and they turned the world upside down. We've got fictional stories in the parables. We've got common culture. We've got parables of Valley of Skeletons, kind of like a zombie movie. We've got, let me read this statement to you from scholar Kenneth E. Bailey. He is an expert on Middle Eastern New Testament studies, and he says this, a biblical story is not simply, now listen closely to this, a biblical story is not simply a delivery system for an idea. You know, in other words, you read the story and you get the doctrine out of it, right? The Good Samaritan means, here's what it means to love your neighbor. Rather, the story first creates a world, then invites the listener to live in that world, to take it on as part of who he or she is. In reading and studying the Bible, ancient tales are not examined merely in order to extract a theological principle or ethical model. I liken it to a scientist in a lab. If you make your theology scientific, there's some good things to that. There's some bad things. If you try to dissect a parable like you dissect a frog in order to figure it out and, here's what the meaning is, or here's the one doctrine that this parable communicates, therefore, now that we've got the doctrine, the parable's, you know, just ornament. What you've done is you've dissected the frog to figure out its parts, and you've killed it. And you're killing the heart of God. Yes, you draw theological truths out of them, but what I'm saying is that Jesus could have used abstract theological discourse. They were in a Hellenistic culture. They weren't idiots. They weren't hicks. He could have chosen abstract theological discourse, but he didn't. He chose parables, right? So my point is that story itself embeds the doctrine better than abstract presentations. That would be my argument. Again, I'm, of course, here today talking to you, giving you a rational lecture, so I'm not denying that, because I'm not an emergent, all right? So I'm not suggesting that we swing to the other side. But we certainly have, I think, neglected, at least my tradition has neglected a lot of that imaginative culture. And, of course, this is my personal favorite. The fantasy horror epic of Revelation. God loves horror. I've got an article coming out in this month in the Christian Research Institute Journal, Apologetics Journal, and it's called An Apologetic of Horror, and I talk about how God loves horror. He uses a lot of the horror genre to communicate his truth. And let's just say God was the first Tolkien. Okay, now I want to show you a clip that sort of embodies what I'm saying really well. And it's a long clip, it's like 5 minutes, but it's just so good that you gotta watch the whole, you gotta watch the whole clip. This is from Dead Poets Society. And this is the scene where John Keaton has returned to teach at his alma mater, and it's a boys' prep school, and it's a stuffy, dry, dead academic world. This is the first day of class on poetry. And the class, they have to take it. It's sort of like, oh, yeah, you got to take the class on poetry, too. But, we have to have our smattering of cultural appreciation as well. But let's see how Keaton communicates the dearth of an intellectual approach to the arts and the need for imagination for who we really are.
Gentlemen, open your text to page 21 of the introduction. Mr. Perry, will you read the opening paragraph of the preface? Entitled Understanding Poetry.
Understanding Poetry by Dr. J. Evans Pritchard, PhD. To fully understand poetry, we must first be fluent with its meter, rhyme, and figures of speech, then ask two questions. One, how artfully has the objective of the poem been rendered? And two, how important is that objective? Question one rates the poem's perfection. Question two rates its importance. And once these questions have been answered, determining the poem's greatness becomes a relatively simple matter. If the poem's score for perfection is plotted on the horizontal of a graph, and its importance is plotted on the vertical, then calculating the total area of the poem yields the measure of its greatness. A sonnet by Byron might score high on the vertical, but only average on the horizontal. A Shakespearean sonnet, on the other hand, would score high both horizontally and vertically, yielding a massive total area, thereby revealing the poem to be truly great. As you proceed through the poetry in this book, practice this rating method. As your ability to evaluate poems in this manner grows, so will your enjoyment and understanding of poetry.
Excrement. That's what I think of Mr. J. Evans Pritchard. We're not laying pipe. We're talking about poetry. How can you describe poetry like American Bandstand? Well, I like Byron. I give him a 42, but I can't dance to it. Now, I want you to rip out that page. Go on. Rip out the entire page. You heard me. Rip it out. Rip it out! Go on. Rip it out! Thank you, Mr. Dalton. Gentlemen, tell you what, not just tear out that page, tear out the entire introduction. I want it gone. History. Leave nothing of it. Rip it out! Rip! Be gone, J. Evans Pritchard, PhD. Rip! Shred! Tear! Rip it out! I want to hear nothing but ripping of Mr. Pritchard. We'll perforate it. Put it on a roll. Not the Bible. You're not going to go to hell for this. Armies of academics going forward, measuring poetry. No! We will not have that here. No more of Mr. J. Evans Pritchard. Now, my class, you will learn to think for yourselves again. You will learn to savor words and language. No matter what anybody tells you, words and ideas can change the world. Now, see that look in Mr. Pitt's eye? Like 19th century literature has nothing to do with going to business school or medical school, right? Maybe. Mr. Hopkins, you may agree with them thinking, yes, we should simply study our Mr. Pritchard and learn our rhyme and meter and go quietly about the business of achieving other ambitions. I have a little secret for you. Huddle up. Huddle up! We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race. And the human race is filled with passion. Medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for. To quote from Whitman, O me, O life, of the questions of these recurring, of the endless trains of the faithless, of cities filled with the foolish, what good amid these, O me, O life? Answer, that you are here, that life exists and identity, that the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse. The powerful play goes on, and you may contribute a verse. What will your verse be?
What will your verse be? You know, we have our systematic theologies again. I like to use that phrase because it's a reference that is out of my past, and which is sort of the application of science to knowing God. You get all your categories down, you get all your facts, and notice how he says the drama of life. There's even some theologians now like Hans Urs von Balthasar and Kevin Van Hooser, who are suggesting an approach to theology that they call theodrama, rather than theology is the study of, but they're saying, no, have a theodrama, a drama of God, because our life and our walk with God is a drama more than it is a science class. So now let's take a look at the Bible, in the Bible, the artist and God. And I want to draw your attention to a few facts. In Exodus 35, where God is going to build the temple, we read, Moses said to the sons of Israel, see, the Lord has called by name Bezalel, and he has filled him with the Spirit of God. Bezalel was an artist. In wisdom, in understanding, and in knowledge, and in all craftsmanship, to make designs so as to perform in every inventive work. Excuse me, this was a reference to God was calling him in order to build the temple. And I'm sorry, the tabernacle. So a couple points I want to make here was the first person in described in the Bible as being filled with the Spirit of God is an artist. This is the first time the Spirit of God filling someone is spoken of. Not that that's the case factually. Maybe there were other people, but it's important to note that the first time that it's indicated is to an artist. And God fills him with wisdom, understanding, knowledge, and craftsmanship. It's important to note that these traits, if you read elsewhere in the Bible, these traits are often linked together with prophets, priests, and kings. Again, I'm not making the point that artists are prophets, priests, and kings, but simply making the point that the language of the artist means that they're very important to God, such that he would use that important language of them. And it is also not enough for artists to be called by God. They must excel in their craftsmanship. God demands excellence in craft, not merely having the right content. Now, those of us who are in the industry know the dilemma of the Christian genre of things, the Christian movies, the Christian this and that, and oftentimes they don't excel in craftsmanship. Then it also goes on to say, he has also put in his heart, Bezalel, to teach. Both he and Oholiab, he has filled them with skill to perform every work of an engraver and designer and broider and weaver and performers of every work and designs. Then Moses called Bezalel and Oholiab, and every skillful person in whom the Lord had put skill, everyone whose heart stirred him to come to the work to perform it. Now, another several points I want to make here is the artist has a responsibility of what he is communicating, all right? Put in his heart to teach. That's not to say your art has to be preachy and didactic, but the point is that your art does communicate a worldview. It does communicate truth to some degree, and you are accountable for what you are saying. You have to be aware of that. It's not just, oh, I'm an artist and I just create. And also, again, every skillful person. These were not merely elitist artists that God was working through. It was through many artists. And next, it also says, skill, skill, skill. Skill, skill, skill. Again, God values excellence of craft. It's very important to God. If we do not value him with excellence in craft, we are dishonoring him. So it's not good enough to do Christian art, because your content's valuable and your style is crap. It does not honor God to be crappy in your craft. And then lastly, whose heart stirred him. So, do you have a passion for your art? It's not just about hearing a voice of God. God wants me to, just your heart stirring you. That's enough. If you've got this skill, you've got a sense of skill, you've worked hard at it, and your heart stirs. So to sum up some major points here, one, God values art and artists highly because he filled them with his Spirit and included wisdom in that. He included understanding in that. He included knowledge in that. Those were job requirements. So he values them highly. Art is a calling. It's not merely a hobby or second-class status to real ministry, the preaching or, whatever, leading a Bible study. It is a calling. It is just as much of a calling. Thirdly, that God values craftsmanship. Do you get that? I said that quite a few times. Skill, excellence. If we don't, we dishonor him. And lastly, four. And God uses the stirring of the heart. We are accountable for the content that we create. Now, for the last film clip that I want to show here is from the movie The Agony and the Ecstasy, which is an old movie with Charlton Heston and Rex Harrison. Charlton Heston's Michelangelo. And he, of course, painted the Sistine Chapel. And this is the movie about him painting the chapel. And I want to show you the little film clip to finish up with at the end. It is at the end of the movie. He's finally finished the ceiling after, you know, I don't know, years or whatever, struggle with the Pope, because he had a on and off again battle with the Pope in painting it. And so they had a struggle through it all. And let's take a look at their final conclusion.
No, Buonarroti, I almost let you off twice. I was sorry for you. Are you glad now that I did not? And grateful. Save your gratitude for one who deserves it. No, no, not I. I take no credit. I was moved by another hand. As easily and skillfully as you move your brush. Strange how he works his will. Let us share pride in having been made his instruments.
It's only painted plaster, Holy Father.
No, my son. It is more than that. Much more. What has it taught you, Michelangelo?
That I am not alone.
And it has taught me that the world is not alone.
Some of you may have seen the C.S. Lewis movie or read his writings, and C.S. Lewis said he read so in order to know that he was not alone. So you are God's instruments. Do you see yourself as that way? Do you see yourself as accountable for your craft as well as the worldview that you're communicating through it? Do you challenge yourself to be both theologically orthodox about God as well as being excellent in your craft? That would be my challenge to you today. And before we'll have a few minutes for questions, but I just wanted to point out the material that I talked about is in word pictures. Like Mike mentioned, I have books, DVDs, and CDs of lectures that you can buy at the back there. Most of what I talked today was in word pictures. My book, Hollywood Worldviews, is about understanding movies, and this is more about the arts. And Hollywood Worldviews is more about movies in particular. And also, I have back there on the web, you can go to hollywoodworldviews.com, and there's all kinds of additional material, free articles and stuff. You can join the Facebook group for Hollywood Worldviews. I've got a movie blog and free articles on both of those. And lastly, if you want to sign up for more information, I've got my email list back there. Just whenever I'm working on some interesting projects or something that I find interesting that I want to let everybody know who's interested in this kind of material, I will email it to you. And I try to be responsible. I don't send you emails every other day. You know, it's like a couple times a month, important things that I'm involved in, including my movies or anything else that I'm involved in. So now I want to take, let's see. Okay, that was additional slides after that. So, a couple minutes for questions. We are going to have the panel discussion, but were there any questions related to what I just spoke about? Mr. Hugh.
Jeremiah being just seems to be like lower on the totem pole. It shouldn't be secular sacred, but it just doesn't seem as important as being a reading sacred. Then I look at like Norman Rockwell or Bing Crosby, who were just horrible people in their personal life, as far as I've read. They surrendered and sacrificed everything, even their own character, and they created, well, I mean, it's debatable, but really good art. But if you're a Christian family man, I mean, you have to stop at some point, the boundary of what they look like. I can't sacrifice everything, put everything on the altar, because there's other things that I, you know. So it just seems like the secular, the atheist, has more breathing room to be better than the Christian.
Yeah, the reason where I would probably have a different view on that is, you indicated it already. We have to be aware of, we are separated by thousands of years of cultural changes and differences, and so yes, we may not be impressed by watching Jeremiah walk around or Isaiah walk around naked or whatever. However, you already indicated that you do have to be aware of your own cultural prejudices. That's why you can't handle that. But in that time period, it was very strong and powerful. But certainly, don't you agree that the point there is, look at all the dramatic uses. Now our drama is movies. Our drama may be theaters and plays, what have you. For me, it's movies, and it's actually TV and movies, because that's the most ubiquitous form that's affecting the world around us. So my point was to show, look at how much imagination God uses to communicate his word. I think our general misunderstanding is to think that the Bible is this description of theology and doctrine, and the point is it's not. It's mostly imagination, it's stories, it's poetry, and the doctrine's embedded in that. So that's all I wanted to bring out, was that actually imagination is the dominant form through which God uses to communicate his truth. And then secondly, in terms of there are bad artists, or artists who have bad lives, et cetera, and many Christians who end up doing the same thing. That's a perennial struggle. I don't know if it's any different than the preachers who fall all over the place. So I'm not sure exactly where you're going with that, other than I would agree that we do have an added responsibility as Christians than the world. That is, we cannot worship art. It can become an idol to us. And yeah, that's a restriction, that's a boundary, that's a limitation. But I've always seen boundaries. See, another modernist prejudice is to see boundaries as negative and oppressive. But see, that's a prejudice of the modern mind that believes we must be absolutely free of all morals and rules and limits. But the best, most creative art, I would argue, is art that's done within limitations. Like Michelangelo had to paint certain topics that the Pope told him to paint, but it's one of the greatest art ever known. I like limitations. You know, some of the best movies, where it was in the golden age, the 40s, where they had the Hays Code that forced them to not be able to do a lot of things, to portray a lot of things in movies that we might think is oppressive, but in some ways it was some of the most creative communication of those sensual or the sinful side. The Hays Code that said, you know, you couldn't portray people sleeping in bed. You couldn't portray how they did crimes, because it would help people learn how to do crimes and all. So they couldn't portray so many things, but they learned ways to do innuendo and to show creatively the same thing. And it ended up being very creative and interesting. So my point is that as a Christian, I don't think we should see our limitations, we can't worship art, so therefore we're not going to be as good as the atheists or whatever. All those limitations that are there, I acknowledge, but use them as our boundaries within to come up with creative innovation. And that's the greater challenge that I think. Nikki.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, it seems like inherent in the question there's an objectification of art as this object, this thing, as opposed to, I felt like what Brian was saying is talking about God as the artist, the whole sense of creativity and imagination, everything from the parting of the Red Sea to the story of Passover, and, you know, I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. Completely embedded in, I mean,
You're right. Well said.
So even in your question, it seems like you're like, oh, those three artists, that's just a minor, where really it's the whole.
By the way, I'll let you do a question, and then that'll be the last one, because we do have to keep moving. But so I'll let you do your question, and then I'll do your question after her.
Well, you know, one of the things, it's more of a personal question, but it replies to everybody, is, you know, the balance between the agenda we have as Christians, and we do have an agenda. We are ambassadors of Christ, and the intuitive, creative side of life, you know, and I find when I give myself over more to the latter, it's like I can't get away from the agenda that I'm called to. I just can't get away from it, the message, you know. And I see finding that kind of 50-50 balance, like whenever one elevates higher than the other, you wind up with something problematic. And so just as a writer, as a filmmaker, as an artist, how do you keep yourself accountable to that, engaging those two together?
Excellent, excellent. That's an excellent question. Here's my theory. Here's what I believe. I don't know if I'm right, but this is how I perceive it, because I've struggled with that. I've struggled greatly between I love rationality, you guys. I'm not down-talking it. It's still my favorite thing. But I also love creativity, and I do see they do kind of battle each other in some ways. And so here's what I believe. I've seen the overly rational, overly agenda-driven Christians. It's just, it's preachy. It's unreal. It doesn't touch me. It's fake. But the Christians who just let go and don't really, aren't concerned with orthodoxy of theology, they're loosey-goosey, and they often communicate things that are like against God, and they may not even intend to do so. I mean, I've read scripts by Christians that were like, you don't realize this is anti-Christian. And I'm not accusing you. You just don't realize it. Okay. So here's my theory. You must make, as a Christian, you should maintain a regular pursuit of seeking to understand the doctrinal truths of God within the scriptures, understanding God, studying his word, whatever, however you're going to do that. Pursue a deep orthodoxy of knowing God. And so that when you pursue the intuitive side, as you seek to, you know, the pursuit of the imaginative, the intuitive, tends to be, you have to sort of like let it go and be open, and or let it go and be open, and the doctrinal side is like Jesus Christ is God, and you can't go against that, you know, that kind of a tension. So if you study regularly and invest yourself in an orthodox belief, then when you do the letting go, you will naturally be drawn, even when you are intuitive, you're going to be naturally drawn towards the things that might be more orthodox truth. So for example, if you're studying pursuing God and loving him and, you know, all that kind of stuff, then when you're coming up with a story, and you're naturally drawn, even if you're not consciously thinking of it, I think, this is my theory, I think that you're going to be naturally drawn, even when you're not thinking of it, to that which might be more orthodox. So for instance, well, should I have my character, okay, my character's going to rob a bank, or someone asks me to rob a bank, you know, what am I going to do? Open my mind. Well, the kind of story ideas you're going to come up with, you're going to probably be drawn more towards the one that will be ultimately ethically more in line. But it doesn't mean it's no less intuitive, because as we all know, every story has a million ways it can go, right? And so that's kind of my goal is that so that I agree that when you're pursuing the intuitive, the imaginative side, there's a degree of letting go and and putting away the agenda. And that's painting or anything. There is that side of it. And I believe we need to do that. So the only way to guard against being left off into a ship into the sea without going anywhere is to be rooted theologically behind you with the orthodoxy of truth, so that wherever you do let go, you're going to be tending in that direction. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's my theory. of how to balance those two. So, sorry if it doesn't make sense.
My question kind of tails on what he was asking. When you're working with the Christian arts group, theater group, how do you get to the excellence point when you have people with limited schedules and they need to rehearse? And rehearsal becomes the big issue where they don't understand the need to rehearse. They think they can wing it. And you're trying to really instill that, you know, just like music, you need to rehearse this and rehearse it and rehearse it and rehearse it. And I'm just curious how you...
Well, you do have the realities of the world, which is having been an artist who's getting paid for his art, graphic design, writing, all kinds of stuff for many years now, I've come to the conclusion that I will never be given the right amount of money for my work or the right amount of time. I don't think I've ever been given a good deadline. And I used to get so frustrated with, like, if you want me to do an excellent job on this logo, you gotta give me more than 3 hours. I need 3 days, not 3 hours. But I never got more, you know, I always got terrible deadlines for all my art that I've been paid for all my life. And so over time, I've just learned to accept that, Brian, you're just gonna have to learn to get better, faster, and that's just the reality of the world. So there's that side of it, which is, and I've embraced that, but then there's the other side is, however, I do seek to get as much rehearsal, as much practice, because I believe in the excellence and quality and all that. So how do you communicate that to others? Well, I don't know, anybody got any ideas? I mean, yeah, it's about the excellence of the craft. It's about, you guys, you know, you have to communicate, and there's different theories in that. Some people, like I know with acting, you know, some people, if they rehearse, they get stale when they do the, you know, when they do, I don't know. So it's all about working with, like if you're a director, you have to learn to work with those different schools of thought in different people and be able to sort of find a compromise, you know. Okay, yeah, I realize you can get stale, but for my sake, maybe can you do this to help me out so that I can be more prepared? And that might be one, you know what I mean? I don't know. There's, well, yeah, there you go. And yeah, if you're a director and you want rehearsal and they don't want to do it, don't hire them. That's a good one.
Yeah. You know, and I don't want to make this sound simple or trite or anything, but especially if we're working with Christians, then there is that, you know, do everything like you're doing it for the Lord. You know, what is this for? You know, as Christians, we whine a lot. I want to do this and I want to do this, so I'm going to kind of sneak in here and do this. And then all of a sudden it gets to a big level, you're going to press junket, and that Christian's going, oh my gosh, his life and his doctrine. Or why did you do that? What is that really showing in the world? That will come up.
Were you talking about Christians in particular?
That's where the dilemma is, too, I guess, is, you know, when you're doing it within a ministry, so to speak, you're trying to kind of reach out and bring people in and make them a part of the whole theatrical ministry or film ministry, but you also want to have some sort of excellence.
I think what she said, you said it well. Yeah, I think her challenge is really great of saying, hey, look, to the person who says, I don't need to rehearse that much because, you know, the Lord will take up the slack or whatever. You can say, hey, look, I really don't see that you're having a sense of doing everything heartily as unto the Lord, and we really need to do that. Even with something that is small or insignificant or whatever, we have to do everything as unto the Lord. And I don't get that sense from you, that you're really putting your whole heart and soul into it for the Lord. because that would require, you know, a little bit of practice, a little bit of rehearsal. I would recommend. And you were going to add something to that?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think foundationally there's a value system that needs to be challenged.
Yeah.
There's no value put into the art. There's no value put into our expression. We're saying, well, we're doing this for the Lord. So, like he said, some people might say, oh, well, you know, we'll pray and God will supernaturally help us become better athletes. God's going to come down. This big miracle is going to happen and our play is just going to come alive.
Yeah.
And it's like, does that ever happen in real life?
The only way that would be justifiable in my mind is, I'm being hired to do this project, I fought as much as I can, but they're only going to give me 2 days to do this, and I need a week to do it right, but I'm being forced to, so I say, Lord, I pray you pick up the slack, I'm going to do my best, but I pray you make up for it, because they didn't give, it's not my fault, it's not my issue. You know what I'm saying? That would be a way that...
You're still working 20 hours a day.
Yeah.
To get it done.
Oh, yeah, and all-nighters, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were just talking about that earlier. Yeah.
Around the cats. But one of the things that I did with them was to try to, before every practice, we had a small time of devotion, just to refocus them on why we were gathered there to do what we're doing. Most of these people had a lot more talent than I did, but they didn't get that it wasn't about their chops necessarily, or, hey, I'm good at this, I'll just wing it Sunday morning or when we have our big event. And that had a way of kind of getting them hunkered down into that right place of we're doing this to glorify God.
Well, this is an ongoing discussion, and I'm sure we'll have more time to. A little break, or?
Yeah, let's take a 5-10 minute break. The restrooms are in the.